I come to you tonight with an unhappy message. Perhaps many of you have already reached the same conclusion. But for those of you who have not, or who remain optimistic in spite of everything going on around us, I will state at the outset that I believe that our side, however anyone in this room wants to define it, have lost the ideological struggle, particularly in the universities. That this is a crucial battle, and that we have lost, but that we have not yet recognized that we have lost. And as a result, we are continuing to lose even more. And until we come to grips with the new reality of what's going on, we're not apt to come up with any solutions to the problem that are going to make a lot of sense. We've read in the last few years some marvelous, marvelous books about universities. D'Souza's, Bloom's book, Slyke's, there are several others as well, that just regale us with stories that fill us with joy as we see what idiots these people are who are running the universities, who are teaching our students. My God, we send our children to those schools to be educated. It is disgraceful what's going on. And yet, it's had very little effect. even some coverage in the New York Times on a book that's extremely well done, but that's about the end. It's all treated as a media event, by and large. No one's significantly interested in the media or in the universities in the substance of the message, because why should they? They're winning, and you're someone complaining about that fact. Instead of what Alan Bloom or D'Souza would advocate as the appropriate manner of behavior in a university, what do we find? We find these bizarre notions of diversity that have absolutely nothing to do with intellect, reason, logic, or decency. Deconstructionism, that is the very death of every great matter in the humanities that has come to us. I happen to have a little bit of sympathy with some of the logic of the deconstructionists, but what they have done to literature and other forms of learning clearly goes much beyond any small matter of whether there is a kind of element of logic here. There's a political agenda, if we know that. Affirmative action continues to flourish in a way to guarantee that the standards of universities decrease, that the opportunities for blacks and other minorities are made less and less as they are constantly deceived into something that is of no value to them, other than a few who run the operations. The student orientations, there was a nice story recently on programs at Columbia, NYU, Stanford, and other schools. Dartmouth, I regret to say, was included in the story. Of what freshmen are confronted with. The day they arrive at an American university today, the pressures to remove any conceptions of tradition, of values that they brought with them from their family and circumstances becomes enormous. They are taught a litany, a dogma. They are brainwashed in the most vile sense of the term brainwashed. The social pressures brought to bear on them to conform to these ideas is so great that they just have no chance. Of course, all of this is reinforced by what's in the media, movies, and modern literature, magazines, and so forth. like better like you. There are bright signs here and there that this does work, yes. There are some bright signs. There have been some victories for our side, to be sure. What do we have that we can point to with pride in the university world? Well, I must start off with one law school. Out of 184 approved by the ABA, a total of over 200, not one beyond that one I was alluding to, could really fall into a description of something that was rational, that held to decent values, that held to scholarly values, traditional intellectual approaches. I think I can estimate maybe there are two political science departments in the entire United States. I can stretch matters a little by bringing in some neutral ones and maybe find four economics departments. Now, of course, we're up into the large numbers. I'm talking about two political science departments out of perhaps the top 200 universities in the United States. Four economics departments out of 200 or 300 schools, to be sure. Maybe two philosophy departments. Afterwards, if anyone wants to, I'll tell you my candidates. You may have others. I may be off. I could be off there by a factor of 100%. There may be four philosophy departments. Strangely enough, only two business schools can. But then I get to a long list of zeros. History departments, English departments, sociology, anthropology, humanities, and so on. To say nothing of the new departments of feminist and black studies. What victories have we had? The most notable, and one that gave us all a real charge, a real sense of warmth, was when somehow this concept of political correctness caught on. I don't know where that started. I haven't found anyone who can tell me yet. It was a matter of genius. There was no question but that it totally threw the left off balance. But I think there has been a failure to understand exactly what it was about and why it was so successful. And let me tell you, and as soon as I say it, you'll recognize that what I say is true. The media of the United States, large newspapers, major magazines, New York Times, Washington Post, and others, began to be concerned about PC when they realized that it was an attack on freedom of the press and freedom of speech. The First Amendment is the special province of the media. They didn't give a damn about the fact that there was rubbish being taught in classes, that idiots were being hired to teach, that there was, written or not, there was a kind of loyalty oath that anyone had to take to get a teaching job in many universities. They didn't care about that. The whole unevenness, the whole enormous shift ideology to the left in universities, that's not what they were concerned about. They were concerned about student newspapers and student-speaking organizations that raised First Amendment issues, nothing else. It served its purpose, it served it well, and it helped us that it happened at all, but it didn't go very far. And as soon as the newspapers and word matter is taken care of, the media of this country will be continued to be delighted with what's going on in the universities. Well, we've had some other victories, too. The last three Nobel Prizes in economics, and about the six out of the last 8 or 10, we can take great, great pride in those. that's very nice to have. Again, all of us who are even tangentially concerned with economics take particular pride in that. It has made a lot of difference. The collapse of the Soviet Union, the evil empire is gone, the Cold War is over. Doesn't seem to have made any difference in American universities. You may have noticed that the Marxists of America were in assembly last week and all carrying placards and buttonholing any reporter or journalist they could find to say that at last we've got that albatross of the Soviet Union off our neck. Now we can get ahead with real socialism. And that sort of thing goes on and on. We've had some intellectual victories. The advent of law and economics scholarship, just in an area that I'm most familiar with, has had an enormous impact in law schools, in some law schools and in parts of more law schools. It's had a little impact in the economics field. It's had some big impact. There is no such thing as a law student today who doesn't have to be able to at least give a short answer to some question. The answer is the Coase theorem. And that's that means we've had a little effect, winning a little battle there, making people see a semblance of intelligence in some environmental areas, some other things. There also are a very large number of individuals scattered throughout American universities. Great people, great minds, great intelligence, great wisdom, great sense, and very little power, because they are scattered in universities all over the country. I don't think that happened intentionally. I believe that's more simply a residual of other things that have been going on in the universities, that some of this lasted in economics. You can find things like reference to the Chicago School of Economics. At the time when that phrase was coined, I think something like 3/4 of the economists in the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago were card-carrying Marxists or Keynesians or something of the sort. Merely the fact that there were 2 or 3 very smart people there gave rise to something called the Chicago School of Law and Economics. It was not dominant then, it's not today, for that matter. So we've won some of these battles at different places and different fields. I'm sure many of you here in history and philosophy and other things could give equal illustrations to the ones I've used here. But we're losing all of the wars. What good does it do simply to have these occasional victories, these occasional episodes that make us feel a little better? Books coming out telling us how very bad everybody is behaving in the university. If the thing continues to get worse and worse and worse. And I can tell you, I've been right in the midst of it. I know others of you have here too. I can't imagine that anyone would disagree with my assessment that it is like a juggernaut, that it is moving absolutely unstoppably, that there is nothing going on in the form of the better scholarship of the right, of coming out of the think tanks of private property and other values that might be make more sense. These aren't making a bit of difference compared to what's going on in the universities. D'Souza, Bloom, Slyke's book all show the symptoms. What they fail to understand, I believe, there's really very little exception to this, they fail to understand how this could happen. What happened from the universities that of the sort that we knew and loved a long time ago, and had vestiges of it even up until 30 or 40 years ago, maybe, they're just gone. Unless we understand the dynamics that took away the university, we don't even have a clue of what we might do to overcome this problem that simply is taking the intellectual world away from us. Taking it is exactly the right word. It's a war. They declared war. We acted like we could go on in debating society and we were bound to win because virtue was on our side. They didn't fight fair. They don't fight fair today. And they fight very hard. And they won. Literally won. It is over. Forget it. You've lost the universities. You've lost all aspects, institutions of the society directly connected with the universities. Why has that happened? There's a nub of it that hits the theme of this conference, but I'm not going to spell it out in detail here. Someone reminded me that I did talk about it at a Philadelphia Society meeting probably 25 years ago. The problem begins with the fact that universities are either government operations or they are non-profit organizations. Both of those have, each of those has one thing in common. Neither of them allows private property. Neither of them allows any individual to own property rights in the operation. There is no residual claimant who can get richer by doing something right and giving the public something the public wants. Instead, these universities get operated in the most bizarre way. In fact, with one exception, you would never expect an institution to be established with this kind of governance. The one exception is churches. Churches, you would expect, to be set up in a way to allow them to avoid any kind of consumer sovereignty. Churches aren't even set up to be democratic. And I think markets are an extreme form of democracy. Churches are set up to promote a given dogma. The word, as it is written, nothing else. They're not set up to have people decide, well, conditions have changed, we're supposed to change with them. Or they're not supposed to be set up to say, well, we're losing members, we better change our dogma so we can buy more members again. Not set up that way for obvious reasons. They were set up, at least in English and American law, as perpetual trusts, always self-perpetuating oligarchy, board of trustees running the organization, and with a great deal of independence and freedom from government intervention. That's how universities were started in the United States. Almost every private university, that's true. And until 1860, 61, the Morrill Act, we didn't have any significant or very large state universities at all. They were set up in that fashion for the reason that I said. They were set up as religious institutions to train children in particular doctrine, to make the marriage market work more efficiently for them, to train ministers for that particular sect. All of this made sense because you could have someone who understood that goal running the institution, and it would be run perfectly efficiently. But there wouldn't be any nonsense about hiring a heretic because we want to have some diversity. In fact, oddly enough, when diversity did finally break out, probably early in this century in some of the Northeast schools, it quickly became castigated as an evil thing. And I have reference to the fact of the many WASP schools, if you will, in the Northeast that began admitting Jews. And that really happened in any number you could count around the turn of the century. And it was a matter of liberalizing. It was a matter of diversifying. And so they put a quota on. They put a quota as a way of liberalizing because quota of 10%, after all, represented a lot more Jews in the among the students than zero, which had been the rule there before. Didn't take any time at all before that quota became vilified, and all quotas were said to be something evil, to be knocked out. And something that really started off as a liberalization became one of the bad things around. The universities around the turn of the century in this country, and I'm focused mainly now on private universities, though, because I think that all the influences ran private to public. Something peculiar began happening. Religion began losing its hold on the trustees and directors of the universities. I don't know why. It just happened. We all know it happened. The advent of science, the diversity of religions that made many people lose faith, whatever it was, that did begin to happen. As a result, there was created a terrible economic or governance problem for these universities. No longer did anyone have any clear goal in mind to allow the direction of the university to be known. You couldn't any longer come up with a coherent set of rules for the behavior of students, or who would teach in the schools, what dogma would be taught, or what lessons would be taught. All of these things began to get confused. The trustees began to find that they were there largely to help raise money. They began buying into the argument that they weren't expert on the dogma of different parts of the university. Certainly they couldn't know about the best in literature, in chemistry, in geology, in economics. They had to defer to the experts. Guess who was forcing that argument on them? The experts. There wasn't anybody else with any real interest. The students would like to be in the position that students are in when they go into a Reebok store and buy their dollars. They let Reebok know what style tennis shoes they want. They couldn't do that because these universities were initially set up heavily subsidized. They were heavily subsidized religious organizations, and that notion has continued in some of the most secular schools in the world, but it makes it very difficult to have proprietary organizations competing with these schools when everybody's out there giving money to the schools, and of course the federal government gets into the business of giving money to the schools. Corporations are heavily into the business of giving money to the schools. What are they giving it for? They're no longer giving it for any clear set of values. They no longer have representatives of their own who give direction and policy to the institutions. Who does that? You can only find one group. You can only find one group who has a clear interest in what gets taught in the university, who gets to teach it, and who gets hired to teach. Also, you might add, who gets admitted to the subsidized position of students. The only one group that has that set of interests is the faculty. And by and large, by, I think, the mid-20s or certainly the early 30s, most universities in America had changed their nature completely. It was only then that you began to hear phrases like academic freedom. Academic freedom was not a concept. Well, you find something with the scientists, going back to the problems of Galileo even, that it would be nice if scientists could do their job scientifically. But by the 20s, English professors and philosophy professors began to pick up on the notion that they know the answers, and they should be free of any interference from anyone else. By World War II, this process was complete. The faculties of America, the senior tenure faculties, owned the universities. Now, they owned them cooperative ownership, a mutual ownership, that's much less efficient than a proprietary ownership. There's no residual claimant, and they have no claim that they can transfer to anyone else, and they have no incentive to run it like a business. They have no incentive to compete for the custom of students, as a shirt manufacturer would of people buying clothes or something of that sort. They just didn't have that kind of incentive. Their incentive was to keep the good life they had. Light teaching loads, no interference, and no responsibility. Be able to get away with anything you want to say, anything you want to do. Now, we all know that somewhere, somehow, an equilibrium sets in, that no one is allowed complete irresponsibility, just as no one is allowed total access to infinite assets. So what restrains these faculty at all? What stops them from doing simply anything without any limits? Not very many. There is one thing. There is one market that operates that faculty are concerned about. The one market that faculty are very concerned about is the one in which they sell their services. And believe me, they want to sell their services in a competitive market. They want to sell their services to the school that will pay a little bit more than the one where they are. Now, I use pay very broadly. It's not just dollars, to be sure. But they want to be able to move on. They don't want complete feudalism, that they're locked in forever into the particular slot that they have in the university. That does something very strange. Since the competition for professors is never based on quality of teaching, that's just unheard of. There are a lot of reasons for that, understandable reasons for that matter. It's very difficult to get good information on that, reliable information, and to build up a reputation on it. Teachers almost never move from one job to another because they have a reputation as a great instructor. They move from one institution to another in their market because they've written something that someone slightly higher on the ladder in the hierarchy likes. It's come to their attention that Joe Blow down at Podunk has written an article that, by golly, agrees with everything I say. It can't go far beyond what I say. It can go just very slightly, marginally beyond, perhaps, but the more it agrees, the better it seems. As a result, in every field, you develop a kind of hierarchy. It's usually determined by the gurus at the top of that particular field, whether it be the American government people at Harvard, whether it be the sociologists in Chicago, or the English professors at Yale. Whatever it is that they're demanding, that will simply come right down a pyramid. And the people at the bottom will bend over backwards to conform to what they see the top of that hierarchy to be demanding. This, in other words, is a perfect recipe for complete lack of any diversity of ideas in universities. It explains why our universities are so very much the same as certainly they are. Well, that situation is bad. You wouldn't have any trouble interpolating into that last notion political and ideological values as well. Why they are the particular ones they are is another story. I think it is also related to the nonprofit world they live in, but I'm not prepared to develop that at this point. Nonetheless, that's, I think, an explanation of why the situation exists that's as bad as it is, and it might suggest what we could do possibly to break out of that. Now we come to the denouement of my talk. ideas here are intended to be not scandalous exactly, but provocative nonetheless. I think there is something that can be done, and that it can might be effective. I don't think there are any guarantees for it. I think that what we ought to do in some way, and I have not got the solution to the some way, that what is needed is a single, large, very, very high-quality university in the United States that gathers together all of these scattered, diffused, intellectually infinite people spread in universities all over the United States, brought together so they can have some strength. They will then be noticed. Now, I've seen that on a small scale with law schools, even on a smaller scale with something called the Law and Economic Center, which some of you may be aware of. We regularly are criticized for not having sufficient diversity. Well, of course, you only have to point to the schools of the accuser and say, where's your law and economics person? Where's your conservative in history and philosophy? Where's your traditional literary people? That doesn't count. It's an argument not even worth having with those people. The truth of the matter is that gaining real strength from getting people together who can deal with each other, not have fights with each other, share some common values, share some common understanding and language, is enormously productive. It just produces an almost explosion of good work that comes out of that milieu. We've seen in recent years the terribly sad picture of what's happened to certainly once the greatest law school in the United States, Harvard, as it has developed real diversity, at least from middle-of-the-road Keynesian, let's say, off to the far, far left, there's diversity. I don't know a single person on the faculty I consider conservative. Nonetheless, even with the range they have, the bloodletting and the fighting has just been disastrous. It's interfered with the students. It has severely interfered with the stature of that law school. And the same is going on in almost every university in the United States today. The story's not fully out. I think the situation is a lot worse than people really understand. But what I'm suggesting to you is that if you could get one place that had a faculty that was known to be sensible, hard-headed, rigorous, objective, not even necessarily so much totally on the same ideological line. If you could get that, it would get a tremendous amount of attention, and more than that, it would begin to create its own market. It would begin to be a place that young scholars could aspire to go to. It could be a place that could create, in a respectable fashion, new standards for writing, for work. We have some of this. There are samples of what I'm saying all over the place. Take Chicago economics in its heyday. There were marvelous free market economists spread in schools all over the United States, some of whom are in this room right now. All of whom got strength from the fact that there was the Chicago School of Economics, and there were people there turning out work that had a kind of coherent cast to it. That's exactly one of the major advantages that I would see from this kind of operation. The media would help. The media, any time an issue came up requiring a story, a controversy, they would always go to liberals whom they can find everywhere, and you can be sure they'd go to this university to get the conservative, because this university would give the correct imprimatur that they'd be looking for. In fact, this would be a university that had worked at trying to develop just that kind of reputation. What would they have to do? Well, they have to do one thing that seems to be under attack today. It would have to be largely a graduate and research institution with a very small undergraduate program. I think it'd have to have some, but that's what would have to be. Now, don't fall victim to this stuff you're hearing today, that professors really ought to be teaching more and doing research less. Yes, that's true for them. But in the school I'm talking about, if you really want to have some victory in the war of ideas, believe me, it's with the research professors and the graduate students who go out to be teachers and not with large numbers of undergraduate students. There are probably, again, some questions of how you do this exactly, but there should probably be no deconstructionist work in the school. PC would be a violation of the First Commandment. There would be no enforced diversity of any kind. Liberalism school should be, certainly. But this coercion that goes on in the name of gender and race and sexual orientation is just nonsense. You want people who are going to be liberal about educational, intellectual matters. How to make this thing work is a little more difficult. It's expensive. If you've ever looked at the costs of education, you begin to see very quickly that it's not easy to make money out of it. Oddly enough, I surprised myself as I developed these notes. I'm not advocating that this be a proprietary university. I think we should follow the present outline given by other universities. In a sense, what I'm asking for is something that harks back to the private religious-oriented schools of the 19th century, except now there's a different kind of, I think, largely secular, although very religious and tolerant organization that we would be running. Faculty pay will have to be very high. On average, to start, it will have to be higher than the comparable people are getting at other institutions. Now, that may not last for long, because as you develop a climate where very good people aspire to go, obviously the market price can decline. But at the outset, the school should compete hard for some of the biggest names at Chicago, at Stanford, at Yale, wherever there are some of these lost, isolated conservative and libertarian scholars around. And the money should be there, and plus the other perks that academics have become used to as well. I would propose that this university, consistent with the idea that the media would always turn to that university for the conservative position, engage in a great deal of interchange with all the other major universities. Never start small. Never say that you're just going to be a little teacher's college. From day one, say that you're going to be the number one research scholarly organization in the world. Interchange with Harvard and Yale and Stanford and Chicago.